All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fuck nicks? What the fucksters? What the fuckheads? Few of you. How's it going? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. Welcome to it. I don't know how long you've been around, but if you're new here, welcome. Just hang out. We've been doing this for over a decade. Jesus, long time. And I talk to people. I used to have them come over to the house and I talk to them. And now we've figured out a way to do it like everybody else on the computer. You can do it on, like my mother was, did you do it on the computer? Are you on the computer today? Did I see you on the computer? Yes. Yeah, we've figured it out. And I tell you, man, once I got the hang of talking to people on the Zoom, it turned out to be really good. We've really yielded some interesting and deeper talks than I think some of the ones that have happened in person, to be quite honest with you. It got to the point where I was talking to somebody. This is weird, but I was talking to somebody the other day on a Zoom interview, and I was having a memory of talking to somebody years ago, but my brain framed it as if it were a Zoom. Like, I remembered talking to the person, but on Zoom. So the context has invaded the actual structure of my mind. Like, my memories are now Zoom memories. Like, I've got a screen in my head that I'm looking at things through. It's a little fucked up. It's a little scary. I'm worried about my mind. Jodie Foster is on the show today. I mean, you know Jodie Foster. Taxi Driver. We talk a lot about some of the movies. The ones I remember, Taxi Driver, Bugsy Malone, The Accused, Little Man Tate, her new movie, The Mauritanian. But also, Jodie Foster is one of those people, when you're my age, I am 57 years old, that you feel like you've grown up with her and known her your whole life. But I also want to point out that because I was trying to be sensitive about it and not dredge up stuff that she had nothing to do with and got dragged into through no actions of her own, some of you might not know what I meant when I brought up all the other crap. You'll be hearing it when I'm talking to her. And what I'm referring to when I said all the other crap that she had to deal with around the time she was in college, when we were talking about that. For those of you who don't know, in 1981, John Hinckley tried to assassinate President Reagan and critically wounded Press Secretary James Brady. And he said he did it to try and impress Jodie Foster. And I think specifically Jodie Foster from Taxi Driver, and Jodie Foster, who was then in college, had to deal with the attention of that sordid type of explosion of attention. So that's what I was referring to. It's weird. Just telling you about this makes me remember years ago a James Brady story. Press Secretary James Brady, who was critically injured, but he lived. And he had brain damage and he was in a wheelchair for the rest of his life, I believe. And the memory I have of him was many years ago, one of the first times I ever did stand-up comedy at a comedy club was with Steve Brill, who is a film director and an old friend of mine from college. We had put together a team act to audition for a show called HBO Live on Campus. It was produced by Catch a Rising Star and HBO. We auditioned for it. We did not get the show, but we were told, because we tanked on a live audition. We'd never been in a comedy club before. And the first time I was at a comedy club was at the Comedy Connection with Steve, and we just ate it. But they did promise us that we could do a spot at Catch a Rising Star in New York City. So we, at some point, went down there. We waited around. We were told we'd have a spot. We went on when there was literally no one there, almost no one there, maybe 10, 12 people. And one of those people was James Brady. I don't know if he enjoyed the show. It sort of made us a little feel a little weird. But that's that story. Not that exciting. Nowhere to go with it. just performed for him once, and he was almost the only person in the room. So I don't know what you're up to lately, folks, but I just, what have I been doing? I watched, I've been watching these Harold Pinter screenplays on the Criterion Channel. I watched a filmed version of his play, The Homecoming, which I found mind-blowing. And I watched The Accident, and I watched The Pumpkin Eater, I think it's called, and Bancroft. All very disturbing, beautifully written. I've been doing a lot of thinking about the writing and doing a lot of thinking about the thinking. And then somebody told me that Adam Curtis has a new documentary series on the BBC called Can't Get You Out of My Head. Now, I don't know if you know Adam Curtis, but I guess it's high time, or maybe the timing is perfect for me to take in another Adam Curtis film, because after I watched Hypernormalization and The Century of Self, it took me, I think, years to kind of process what was put in my head by Adam Curtis. Now, this new one is the same. He pulls a lot of things together. He goes out of his way in the first episode of this series to kind of put some things into perspective that need putting into perspective, like understanding how and why conspiracy theories kind of fit into the modern brain. It's a big net he's throwing with a lot of strands tying together. But his tracking of the Illuminati conspiracy back to the Discordians, who were almost a couple of hippie pranksters looking to fight against the dominant paradigm and against organized religion, and created this religion. And then they did some kind of pranks in the letter column of Playboy, which introduced the idea that the Illuminati was running the world. It was a joke. It was a fucking joke. And look where we are. Now we have the punchline of that joke, at least 80% of them, trying to take over the U.S. Capitol and stop the elections. The punchlines of a joke, the joke of religion, the joke of the conspiracy, the joke of Zionist-occupied government, the joke of connecting the dots in the frightened minds of those who want some sense of closure and order and power, who want to simplify it, to want to find places and things to blame and justification for their hatred and fear. It started as a fucking hippie prank. Now look at you. Jesus Christ. But that is not what the documentary series is about. It's really about the construction of our minds and our sense of selves and how they relate to the dominant power structure and what power has to do culturally, politically, economically with how we see ourselves, literally, with how we see ourselves from our fucking brains. And I'm only two episodes in, and we're already dealing with the evolution of the government of, you know, this country, of China, of Russia, of film, of literature, in terms of trying to understand the mind, you know, the idea of binary logic and how that was initially used or meant to be an exploration of how the human brain works, but years later was used as the foundation of how artificial intelligence. Dude, dudettes, people, he, she, them, you're got to watch it. Look, man, I don't know. I'm sure there's a lot of pushback around it, but the guy's an artist, man. He's a fucking artist. And this is an unpaid plug. Fucking Adam Curtis always blows my mind. And it gets my brain going in ways, and it fills in some blanks that need to be filled in. And there's plenty of time to do the thinking. Plenty of time to do the thinking. I think I'm getting a kitten in a few weeks. Just going to put that out there. So, Jodie Foster. Now, I'll tell you the high point of my conversation with Jodie Foster, and it's sort of odd because, you know, it just stuck with me. And I'm sure you'll notice it. I don't even know if I have to bring it to your attention. But when she recollects an egg salad sandwich in the canteen of Disney Studios, the cafeteria at Disney, it was so great to watch her do it. She went there, man. She went back to that sandwich. This is me talking to Jodie Foster. Her new film, The Mauritanian, is in theaters now and will be available on digital platforms in the near future. It's a true story about the detention of a prisoner at Guantanamo Bay for 14 years without a charge. It's directed by Kevin MacDonald, who some of you might know about from this show and a mistake involving him several years ago. But all that aside, this is me talking to Jody Foley. Every now and then, there's a decision that's a no-brainer. And I can tell you from experience, it was a no-brainer to use Stamps.com when we started using it 11 years ago. Crazy. 11 years ago.
Now, more than a decade later, Stamps.com is better than ever. The Stamps.com mobile app is like having a post office in your pocket wherever you are. You can take care of things on the go, like mailing checks, sending invoices, legal documents, and more. Easily schedule package pickups through your Stamps.com dashboard. And when you need to take care of shipping, all you need is a computer and printer. Stamps.com even sends you a free scale. Make the same no-brainer decision that over 1 million other businesses have with Stamps.com. Sign up with the promo code WTF for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. Just go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the page, and enter code WTF.
Buster.
I see Jodie Foster on the screen, and I hear her. Hi, Jodie Foster.
Hi there.
How are you?
Pretty good. Pretty good. You know, it's a beautiful day. I'm looking out. I see palm trees and blue sky. I suppose we need to be grateful.
I do that every day. I see palm trees from my porch, too, and I think, like, it can't be that bad. It's winter. It's 70 degrees. The sky is clear.
That is true.
And then you look at your phone and you go, oh, fuck, we're in trouble.
Yeah, I guess the moral of the story is maybe don't look at your phone so much.
Right, you know? Right. Try to limit that. Try to limit, like, do you ever just, like, wake up and in bed do it to yourself with the phone?
Are you, every morning?
It's the worst.
Every morning. Yeah, it's a terrible thing. I don't know. I feel like if I don't, if I'm not watching, that the world will implode.
Oh, you're going to stop
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I'm the magic, you know, the magic unicorn that only I, if I'm not watching, terrible things will happen.
Thank God we made it another day because Jodie Foster looked at her phone when she woke up.
That's right. Uh-oh, whoops.
What happened? Oh, you froze up a little. Sorry. So,
my phone just went on. I have to do that thing where you go like, you hover over notifications. What do you do? There's some like thing you're supposed to do. Shit, I don't know how to do it. Oh well. Can you tell that I'm over 50? Can't figure out where the mute button is and don't know how to turn the alerts off on my.
Yeah, I'm the same. Yeah, but you know, there's some people that are older than us that still have AOL addresses. I mean, I'm assuming that you've moved past the AOL address. That's always surefire indicator when you see the AOL address. Uh-oh.
Yeah, I have learned a little bit in the last few years, but I have like, it's the only place where road rage comes out on me is I have like computer rage.
Oh yeah.
If something happens or I lose something or something freezes, suddenly I start, you know, screaming and stomping my feet and acting like a 5-year-old.
Right, because we don't know what the recourse is. If you're in a car, you pull over, the brakes, whatever. You know how to drive a car.
Yes.
But that powerlessness, that feeling of like, I have no idea. And you know that people, there are people that know how to do it, but it's not you.
No, my children know how, but they're teaching me, so that's okay. I mean, look, the movie business changed a lot, and in some ways for the better and in some ways for the worse. I mean, now, for example, you used to have to, if you were going to scout for a location, you would send a scout out and that person would travel across the country. And then they would take a bunch of shots on their camera. They would do them in kind of like an arc so that they were able to get a perspective. They take 10 shots. Then they go to the 1-hour photo. They'd sit there and wait for an hour. When they got the photos, they would tape them up with Scotch tape, put them all together. And then they'd put them in an envelope and send them to you, and you would get them 3 days later. And then you'd look at them and go, I don't know, what happens over there?
Yeah.
And then suddenly they have to go back to the place. Nowadays, all you do is, you know, push a button on your phone. And
yeah, the guy's there. They're there already, and you can look in real time.
That's right.
So it tightens things up. So now is everybody at home because of the lockdown? Have you been spending an inordinate amount of time with the family?
Yes, and it's all good. Both my boys are leaving. They're going back to college. The little one wasn't able to go to college for his freshman year. So this is, he's been doing it all from Zoom from home. So that was really sad. My older one has been in college, so that's been better. But
your older one, he's able to go?
Yeah, older one's been there. He said it's the best year he's ever had. So go figure. I don't know.
Really? No, and nobody's gotten sick. Everybody's good.
No, I think his school really figured it out. They have their own testing sites, and they're on top of it. And,
oh, that's great.
So they had very little impact. I think people really followed the rules. And as far as my son's concerned, you know, doing school in bed sounds like the best thing he's ever heard of.
What are they studying?
My older one is really into theater.
Wow.
He definitely wants to be an actor. He does a lot of writing and stand up.
He does stand up?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Do I know him? Have I seen him? Is he,
no,
has he
I
done
don't think
the clubs?
You have.
Oh, okay.
You'll know him because he talks about his mom a lot. I mean, I think that kind of tells you, when you don't have a lot of experience, you find that your stand up has a lot to do with your mom.
But does he say, my mother, Jodie Foster?
No, he doesn't do that. Thank God he doesn't do that.
Do you take a hit? Are you okay with what he's saying?
Oh, yeah, boy. I don't mind. I mean, you know, I'm one of those people that, like, I dress up for Super Bowl.
Sure.
So I don't have a problem people making fun of me.
You dress up for Super Bowl?
I draw the line at playoffs, however.
Okay, good. Yeah. It's funny because I was like thinking about you and thinking about my life and how like you've been there my entire life. We're about the same age. And it's weird because I was realizing yesterday when I was thinking about it, like how that Bugsy Malone was a very important movie to me.
Really? It was? Oh, that's so nice to hear.
But it was sort of a big deal, you know, because it was kids in a grown-up movie and the guns shot pies. I mean, it was a big deal. I mean, what year was that? I mean, how old was I? I don't want to, now I'm going to find out.
I was 12 when I did it.
So I was like 11.
So you're about 13.
11 or 12 too. And it was just sort of like, it was like a really fun, like we were excited to go. I remember it was like a new kind of movie.
Yeah, it was. Actually, it was a British film. A lot of people don't realize that. Alan Parker's first movie was entirely a British production. There were four of us, maybe five of us, that were brought from the United States. And everybody else were kids that were either British or they were living on American Army bases in outside of London.
Really?
So it was kind of like going to a very rough public school in Manchester or something, you know?
Yeah.
There were the girls that were the dancers. Mm. None of them had their parents with them. So they were all living in these kind of, they had minders and they were living in these like dormitories.
Huh.
And there was a whole group of girls from Liverpool and they were the dancers.
Wow.
And the dancers, you go down to the corridors at Pinewood and the dancers would cut you off at the end of the corridor with fire extinguishers. And they'd say, what's the password? And you'd be like, oh wait, that was Scottish. Anyways, what's the password?
Yeah.
And I'd be like, I don't know. And then they would shoot you. It was terrifying.
The trauma of the Bugsy Malone set.
Yeah, all of us with our, you know, bleached hair and our pencil thin eyebrows. And it was a lot of fun. And I think such a creative, interesting film.
Yeah, it was interesting. And it showed up in a Black Mirror episode.
Did it?
It did. Like I just did a movie with Andrea Riceborough. And she was in a Black Mirror episode.
She was.
Crocodile. And the
Crocodile.
Kids, and the kids were doing Bugsy Malone on stage. You remember in the school play?
You're right. Yeah, right? You're right. That is right. They go to the school play. Yeah, absolutely.
And then, but you directed an episode in the same season of Black Mirror?
I did.
Is it because you love that show? Did you seek that out?
Love that show. I didn't seek it out. They found me and I had actually never seen the show. So,
you had to immerse yourself?
I saw the pig episode and I was like, I'm in. Charlie Brooker is such an amazing mind. I don't know how he does it. And you know, he writes every single one of those, crazy things comes out of his head. And what's strange about him is that he seems to have some kind of weird prescient voodoo thing where he's able to manifest whatever is in his mind. He's able to manifest in the future of the news, basically.
Right.
So he just came up with the idea about, you know, bees carrying sort of, you know, robot bees carrying viruses and stuff. And then suddenly that appears years later in amazing.
So he's that guy. He's the prophet guy. He's the guy where you watch his shows. You're like, oh, we're in trouble. It's never a bright future, I guess, with his prophesizing.
No, no, but I had, I really have to commend him that he set out to do something that nobody had really ever done before. This idea of doing an anthology series where each one was a little feature, and he gave complete and total control to the directors, just like you would on a movie. So each director has, you know, it's a brand new cast, it's a brand new crew, it's a brand new location, brand new editor, brand new composer.
Really? So you don't have to honor a look at all. There, you know, there, it's up to you.
No, I mean, they have some ideas about what they're looking for, obviously, and he's a wonderful producer that travels with you. But no, it's really up to the director, and I thought that was so brave of him to do that, and I think that's what makes the show as powerful as it is.
Yeah, because you layer in a real auteur vision, as opposed to just hire a director to honor the vision that's already there.
Yeah, I mean, I love, you know, I've loved every one of the episodes in that season. I just thought it was extraordinary. I mean, look at something like Crocodile, and it couldn't be any more different than, you know, what I did with Archangel. I mean, my film is like a little indie movie about a mother and a daughter.
Right.
And I really wanted to keep that indie, that kind of messy indie spirit. And you look at some of the other movies in there. I mean, we were just talking about Crocodile. So you look at that with that incredible landscape, that almost Icelandic landscape.
It is. I think it is.
Modern architecture houses and
bleak.
Just extraordinary.
Bleak and beautiful. And she said that her part, it was written for Guy Pearce. And
is
she,
that right?
Yeah. And she pushed them to give her the part.
Good for her. Good for her. See, sometimes I've done that before. Where you shift the gender, and there's sometimes it works and it's just incredibly powerful, and other times, you know, it should never happen. But
you've done it as a director or as a you took a role
that, as an actress.
Oh, really?
I did that. I think for Flight Plan, that was originally a man, and which really didn't make any sense. So with the second you changed it to a woman, then suddenly there was a whole history of female hysteria, the idea of female hysteria and how that's translated into, you know, other films. And I don't know, suddenly it became so much more rich.
Right. Well, why wouldn't it? It's a completely different point of view. So I used to do a joke in my act about how people who come to Hollywood expecting to become stars are sort of misunderstanding the situation out here. I used to say that Hollywood isn't your parents. They're not here to take care. It's not here as an entity to take care of you and continue your adulthood and guide you. But oddly, it kind of was your parents, wasn't it?
Well, it was definitely my brothers and sisters, for sure. I feel like I was raised by, I was raised on movie sets by all these, you know, wonderful people who taught me hard lessons and
they did, right?
Cared about me and took care of me. Yeah. I mean, I know how to whittle wood. For some reason,
from
I'm not
where'd
sure
you
how
learn,
that happened.
Where'd you learn that? On the Mayberry set?
Some teamster. I don't know.
Oh,
I think
really?
It was on Tom Sawyer, where I spent a lot of time whittling wood. And I know how, you know, I came to really understand the camera from every technician's point of view, which was nice to kind of get that film school from them.
Yeah. Was your mom, though? Your mom was in show business?
No. Well, I guess she was. Yeah. She had been a publicist before I was born. For a kind of famous guy.
Which guy?
Arthur Jacobs.
The producer, right?
He became a producer. Originally, he was a manager and a publicist.
He's sort of a character, though, right? You know, he's sort of
He was. He produced the Planet of the Apes movies.
And Dr. Doolittle, didn't he?
Dr. Doolittle, yeah, he did. But when he was a publicist, he handled, you know, Grace Kelly, and he handled Marilyn Monroe. Actually, I think that he was like the first person who was on the scene when Marilyn Monroe died.
Really? And your mom worked for him?
Yeah.
I'm just reading about him in this book about those five movies, the transitional, Dr. Doolittle, The Graduate, In the Heat of the Night, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, and Bonnie and Clyde.
It's, why are all those movies put together?
Mark Harris is the guy's name. Oh, he's Tony Kushner's husband, and he's written three books. He just wrote a book about Mike Nichols, and he wrote this book. It's sort of the same angle as Biskin's book, but his thesis is that it happened earlier. The transition started in the earlier to mid 60s with The Graduate, In the Heat of the Night, Bonnie and Clyde, and it wasn't, you know, the explosion of those guys that happened in the early 70s, but Doolittle was sort of the end of it. But Jacobs is all over this book, and it's just like, I don't, you know about it because, you know, you did it, but he really gets into the nuts and bolts of producing a movie like Doolittle and what a disaster it just unfolded into. And poor Arthur Jacobs was ailing. He was having heart problems, and it was like it almost killed him.
Yeah, there's lots of wonderful stories about how movies are made. You know, I just have such nostalgia. I mean, it's my whole childhood.
Do you remember Walt Disney?
No, I've never met Walt Disney. I think he's probably dead by the time I was pretty young. But I knew Ron Miller, who ran the studio after that, his son-in-law. And I knew everybody at Disney. Chris, I was a Disney kid, right? So right. I made like 4 or 5 films there.
Like Kurt Russell, was he around?
Yeah, he was around. I mean, I've met him vaguely. I don't remember because I was a kid and he was, you know, older. But yeah, Kurt Russell was around that same time period.
It must have been crazy on the set at Disney. I mean...
I did a lot of movies with animals and all of my movies were on location. So I never really worked on stage. I guess I worked on stage for one part of like Freaky Friday. I guess I worked on stage for some of it over there. But
yeah,
my memories of Disney is, you know, they used to invite me to all of the Disney events at the park.
Yeah.
And I would have to kind of like be in a parade or, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
I loved it. I loved it. I got to see the opening of the Abraham Lincoln ride that was there on Main Street and
President Tall or whatever.
Yeah, and I was there for Jungle something Jamboree.
The Bears.
And I got to take my family and go around. So I remember that. I also remember the commissary at Disney that had. I discovered egg salad sandwiches. I'd never had an egg salad sandwich. And I remember
that's a big deal.
Well, it was the perfect egg salad sandwich because it was super cold and it had a little iceberg lettuce.
Nice.
Those are my memories.
Those are good memories. But now, how does it kind of factor? When did you start to realize, like, because it was pretty clear early on that you had, you know, you were kind of a whiz kid and you could take on languages and everything else. I mean, but did you ever, when you were a kid, think that show business was like, you wanted to do something else early on, or were you just so immersed in it that was your life?
Well, I never thought I would be an actor when I grew up. And my mom was very keen on asking me all the time, like, oh, so are you going to be a lawyer? Or are you going to be a doctor?
Really?
Or, you know, she did not want me to grow comfortable with the idea that I would be an actor when I grew up, because no child actors ever grew up to be adult actors.
It never goes well, rarely.
Yeah. Well, I don't know that it never goes well. I think most child actors, it goes well. You just never hear from them again because they become real estate people.
Yeah, they become healthy people who have regular lives.
Yeah. So she didn't want to encourage it. And I think she kept telling me that by the time that I was, you know, 15 or 16, that my career would be over. And what did I want to do after that? So I never thought I would be an actor. And I kind of thought, as a very young person, I thought it was a dumb job because all I understood it to be was, you know, you learn lines that someone else wrote and then you said them. And that just seemed, there was no way that I was going to be happy with just that.
But so you had a knack for it. No one ever, you never went to a class or you never trained or you never, it was just, you just had a knack for it.
Yeah, I guess so. And I've worked with a lot of child actors, some who have undergone some training and some like the little boy and little man Tate, who have never done anything. I mean, he had never even been in a school play. He just was a kid that my casting director found in a cute public school in Manhattan. You know, that was it. It's not necessarily something you can teach. But what you get when you have very young actors is that there's a kind of self-consciousness that they don't have when they're very young. So you catch somebody before they're nine years old, they don't have the kind of self-consciousness you start getting at 9, 10, 11, 12 years old. I didn't think I would be an actor. And then I went to college. I thought, after college, my mom said after college, you know, you won't be an actor anymore. And then I continued. And then she said, when you turn 40, after you turn 40, that's it. You'll never work again. But I kept waiting. Then I turned 40 and I was like, I better work a lot. And then it kept going.
You know? She kept thinking you weren't, but she had to have seen at some point that, you know, you were definitely branching out and that your business and your intellect and your creativity had become much bigger than acting.
Yeah, I think she was pretty proud of that. I mean, she was proud of directing, and she was very supportive of that. She was really supportive of me going to college, and which at the time I think was really anathema for an actor.
Well, yeah, I mean, it reminded me of like it's always sort of this weird big deal when actors go to, like, I remember when Natalie Portman and Claire Danes, like, you know, any actress that decides to stop and go to school, it's like, oh my God, what are they doing? You know?
Yeah. And it was such an important step for me.
Yeah. Well, going back though, like, did you, like you're talking about Dr. Doolittle or talking about this shift. I mean, you were doing television, like all the old television, like black and white television even, right? A bit at the beginning.
Yeah.
So you knew all these, you knew like, you know, Rod Serling and Andy Griffith and all these, you know, like what's his name? Arnett from Gunsmoke. You worked with all of those guys.
Yeah. Yeah. Gunsmoke. I did all those, you know, dramatic opuses like Nanny and the Professor. And My Three Sons and, you know, all those 70s,
Fred McMurray.
70s shows.
You remember Fred McMurray? Nice guy.
Yeah, very nice guy. Yeah.
Partridge Family. You did the Partridge Family?
I think only did one show of the Partridge Family. I went out for the Partridge Family to be a regular, to be one of the kids, and I didn't get it. So,
in your mind, like when you think back on some of these people that you've come across in your life, I mean, are there people that stood out to you as a kid that, you know, had more of an impact than others?
I feel, well, Taxi Driver really changed everything. I think until I did Taxi Driver, and I was 12 years old when I did Taxi Driver, I think that I didn't really take it all very seriously as much as I loved movies. And I really was, my mom was a big fan of films, and we saw lots of foreign films, and we would see movies over and over and over again. And
you could understand French, so that was good for the foreign film.
So we were really a big movie family, big movie fan family. But even though I loved movies, I didn't understand that acting was more than just saying lines until I did Taxi Driver. And that to me was like a mind altering trajectory for me.
And was it the sort of the triangle of you and De Niro and Scorsese?
I think he took the time. I think De Niro really took the time with me. Scorsese kind of sent the two of us out, or maybe De Niro did it on his own, because he, at that time, he was very immersive.
Yeah.
And he'd pick me up every day in New York, and we go to a different diner, and we just keep running the lines, which I didn't really understand why we kept running the lines over and over again. And then by the third time that we did this, he started improvising and going off on all these tangents. And at that point, I think we felt comfortable with each other enough to be able to go back into the text.
Right.
And it was something about that process that I really understood that it was my fault as an actor that I had not contributed enough, and that there was a whole rich universe of understanding in terms of character that I had just been, you know, blind to.
Really? And you just sort of realized that through the repetition and then through improvising.
Yeah, and then watching the scene take place, watching what Scorsese did, then ultimately really seeing the movie and seeing how those things all dovetailed and how they came together. It was such an inspiring experience. And it probably also coincided with all those amazing movies like Lenny, you know, Straw Dogs, and Midnight Cowboy.
You saw those when you were 12?
Oh yeah, we're a big movie family, and we saw really serious movies. I mean, my mom never kept me away from R-rated films, and we saw some pretty serious movies.
When you were on the set, like in talking, like even in that thing we were talking about earlier, the shift in how movies were made and the shift in Hollywood, did you feel that the set was different? I mean, you've been on, you know, 50 sets already.
Yeah, it was different. You know, Scorsese, every director that you work with is different. So Scorsese was, his method was more unusual than I had seen before. He used hundreds of thousands of feet of film, and he did take after take after take after take of the same thing over and over again, same angle.
Wow.
And he had just, that was his deal, which is just to have an exhaustive amount of film and to comb through it and just look for surprises, you know?
Yeah. So you got an Oscar for that, right?
No, I got nominated
for
supporting.
What did you win an Oscar for? Oh,
Accused and Silence of the Lambs. Yeah.
Those are great movies.
Yeah, those are some good films.
I didn't mean, I hope you didn't think it was rude that I asked you those questions.
No, I don't care.
Well, it's important. But
I don't know how important it is.
Of course it's important. I mean, I was thinking about that. I was talking to my producer yesterday about The Accused, and I'd seen it. I saw it not too long ago, and I said to him, I said, I think that's one of the best performances of anything ever. Like it's
really?
Yeah. Because the
I don't have any objectivity about that performance.
Why is that?
You know, I kind of felt, it was interesting. I felt like a little bit of a failure when I made that movie because there were things that the producers and the director were trying to encourage me to do differently.
Huh.
And I couldn't. I felt like I really came to understand the character and I had made these decisions about the character that I just couldn't abandon, even though they asked me to abandon them in order to accomplish some kind of goal that they had.
Like which ones?
Well, I remember, for example, that the producer who I really loved this guy, Stanley Jaffe.
Yeah.
He just was a cool guy, crazy guy. And definitely made a lot of people nuts, but I really liked him.
He was an old timer too, right? Been around a long time.
He was an old timer, yeah. He made me, he exerted a lot of power on the set and he was there every day. And he had a lot of opinions about, you know, everything from how mini my mini skirt should be to how I should smoke.
Right.
And I was a smoker at the time and he was not happy with how I smoked.
Huh.
And he made me reshoot the same scene twice because of the way I smoked. And I was just like, sorry.
How are you
going to? That's the way it is. And
how are you going to, you know, change something like that and get hung up on it in the middle of that performance? You're going to worry about, you know.
Yeah, there was a lot of intervening at the time because I think people were worried. They were worried that, oh, she's too tough or, oh, she's too unlikable or she's. And granted, there was a part of me that worried about that too. I just couldn't do it any differently. I just knew her and that's how she was. So, for example, the courtroom scene, I think we had a lot of problems with the courtroom scene. They had a lot of problems with it in the cut. And I think that Jonathan was hoping or expected for a different kind of performance than the one that I was able to give. So when I finished that movie, I just felt like a bad actor. I just felt like, wow, I'm a bad actor because I couldn't make this character more likable for them, you know?
But that's such a weird kind of Hollywood note. Now that I'm thinking about Stanley Jaffe, he's one of those guys that had a reputation of being sort of a control freak, I think.
Yeah. He's Sherry Lansing's producer at Paramount as well. And yeah, he did lots of big movies.
Right.
I really like the guy. So I have a real fondness for him. And he was kind of old school. And I think they didn't really understand what they had. And they were worried. I think they were worried that the character would be offensive to people. And I guess
that's interesting.
I sort of internalized that. And I was like, gosh, I wish I could make her less offensive. I'm so sorry. This is what I got. And in the end, I think it was instinct and I think I was right. And it really taught me that you can't accommodate other people when it's about fear.
It's also part of it. It also works for the character. I mean, like, yeah. That the, you know, to create that insecurity and that overcompensating and the attempting to please everybody, you know, in these moments. I mean, that is part of the brokenness of that character. And I think that what they probably misunderstood was the vulnerability that you were able to access in the middle of all that, because it wasn't something in movies necessarily.
Yeah, and that's okay. Like, this is part of the process. This is why we do what we do. We fight for things that we know are important, even though we don't understand why they're important. And sometimes that challenge, that process of challenging authority and challenging other people, like, that's how movies get made. So I don't have a problem with that. I feel like that's kind of what we do. But it's hard for me because I'm a people-pleasing good girl.
Right.
Like, I like to take notes and I like to get good grades and I'm not a rebel. And so that movie taught me a lot.
But you've able to you know, manage that particular problem, the people pleasing part.
I think I have. You know, there's parts of it that I've learned to let go of, and then other parts of it that I'm just, you know, just damned with.
Well, it's hard. I guess the big challenge there is just making sure you have some boundaries and you don't let yourself get trampled.
Yeah, look, sometimes you make a choice in a character and it's a bad choice. That's really possible. I've made I've made mistakes with a character before, and I can look later and go like, oh, maybe I shouldn't have done that or whatever. But the only thing you can do is operate on instinctually what you know to be true. And you make that, you have to live by that, whether it works for the film or whether it doesn't work for the film. Because if you don't have that, you don't have anything.
But The Accused was a huge movie, because it seemed like, you know, after you went off to college, you know, mm-hmm. I don't know a lot of those movies. Do you remember the
lot? Yeah. Yeah, I made 5 movies while I was in college, and none of them were successful.
None of them.
Yeah.
did you like any of those movies?
Yeah, I loved Hotel New Hampshire. I thought that was a great movie.
That was sort of, it was one of those big casts, right?
Yeah, Hotel New Hampshire. I'm trying to think which are the other ones. That one was bad.
Blood,
that
the Blood of bad. Others.
Well, that was yeah, I mean, they're all adventures. They just weren't, the movies didn't quite work.
But you had to deal with all that other crap too, that you were dealing with, that somehow you managed to, that must've been some lesson in creating personal boundaries, that the John Hinckley stuff.
Yeah, it was. It's a weird moment in my life. You know,
but I transcended. It was kind of amazing.
Yes. I mean, I skillfully transcended,
right?
Because my mom, who had been a publicist, was very clear that she tried to guide me to make sure that I wasn't just going to be known as the person who was involved in, involved in the shooting of the president.
And, attached to it.
Attached to it. Yeah. So she said, you know, you want to have a career that's not about this, so you're going to never talk about it. And, you know, you'll do whatever you need to do for the court case, and then that's it. You won't talk about it. What I did is I wrote a piece for Esquire magazine, that was sort of a first person piece, and I had an attachment to them because I'd worked there as an intern. And, that was it. I had written what I had to write about it. I got it out, and there was nothing more to say about it.
And that was policy.
Yeah, it took some enforcement. I'm not sure that you could enforce that these days because, you know, we have a different relationship with the press now. I don't know.
What do you make of that? How do you characterize that different relationship?
It's just a different time. You know, it's a different time. It's a different culture. You know, we didn't have long lenses like that, zoom lenses. We didn't have the internet. We didn't have social media.
Thank God.
You know, it was just a different time to grow up in. I feel sorry for young actors that are growing up in this time that are trying to navigate becoming humans and being a celebrity at the same time. Like, I don't really know how you do that.
Right. Because there's also the pressure to have the role of what you decide your private life, what of it is going to be available. And how you're going to handle that. Like, there's no way to avoid it.
Yeah, it's not entirely in your control. I don't know. I mean, it was a different time then. I feel very lucky that I was raised in that time and not this one.
And when did you know that you had succeeded in distancing yourself from that?
From what?
From the Hinckley problem.
I don't know that I did. I think, it took a lot of enforcement. And yeah. I don't know that I did. I mean, I don't know. I guess I did the best I could.
Well, I didn't. It was weird because when I knew I was going to talk to you, and after I watched the new movie, like and then I was just sort of thinking about you, that I didn't realize until 2 days ago. I texted my producer. I'm like, oh yeah, that Hinckley thing. Like, it wasn't. It was nowhere near the first thing I thought about. And I grew up with you.
That was, you know, it's a testament to my mom.
Oh, well, I mean, good.
You know, I think she was able to find a good strategy to make sure that that happened.
And how much did it affect your personal life in general, just in terms of being out in the world and doing stuff? And I guess the whole thing was kind of isolating.
Yeah, it was a weird time in history. It really was a weird time for me personally, weird time for, the movie business. And strange.
And you started directing pretty shortly after The Accused?
No. But I guess it was short in real years. I guess it was short. So I was 26 and a half, 27 when I first directed. The Accused, I was probably a year out of college, 2 years out of college. So I was probably like 24.
Wow. I mean, I'm just thinking about The Accused. I like that. I mean, that movie just had such an effect on me. And also, I think it's relevant to, you know, sort of, you know, destructive groupthink, you know, horrendous transgressions that are done by people who are kind of like just glom on to evil.
Well, it's a human phenomenon. You know, they're all human beings. It's a human phenomenon. Yeah. I mean, it was an eye-opening experience for me. And I was young. I was only 24. And I'm not sure I think I came onto that movie with a lot of fears and a lot of unconsciousness. You know, I wasn't an aware person at 24. So I read the script once and, you know, maybe I met with one rape counselor, but that was pretty much all the research I did besides going dancing a lot in clubs. That was pretty much it. And I think I was scared to think about it any more than that. I didn't really want to think about it.
Right.
So I think that performance came out of that unconsciousness.
Was the dancing in clubs the scariest part of the research?
It was the most fun part of the research.
But did you see those men around?
No, not really. I mean, that's not, I think I just wanted to be in the experience of feeling free.
Right.
You know, because that's, you have to have that in order to have this sequence feel impactful.
Yeah.
What happens before that sequence is very important. Mm. Like, this is a woman who's having the best night of her life, you know, where she feels free and confident and that she doesn't have to feel threatened. She can just be herself.
Yeah. It's so heartbreaking, the whole thing. But like but you did Silence of the Lambs before Little Man Tate came out, huh? So Silence of the Lambs, that happened pretty quickly.
Year.
Well, I mean, I guess within a couple of years. And that character, again, how did you approach that character?
Well, that one, there was a lot of research to do on that one, right? So I went to, read a lot of books.
Did you go to the FBI?
I spent some time in Quantico. I spent a few days in Quantico. I slept over there and stuff and hung out with people. I met with a bunch of FBI people. I did a lot of research there, you know, on forensics and on shooting guns and, climbing the marine things.
But it's interesting that the core of that thing is also sort of your vulnerability in the face of monsters.
Well, that's Clarice. The greatest thing about Silence of the Lambs, and I think why it is such a great film, is that the book was just this almost magical unicorn that came out of nowhere. Mm. I think it's the best thing that Thomas Harris has ever written, for sure. And so inspired, and it so inspired all of us. Actually, every single one of us, whether it's Ted Talley, the writer, or Howard Shore, the composer, or me and Tony and Jonathan Demme, or Tak Fujimoto, the DP, I think it's for all of us, it's the best work that we've ever done. And we all have this like sinking feeling that we'll never reach that again. And mostly it's because the book was just this perfect thing.
Huh.
It gave so much detail to those characters and so much texture to it that all of us were just completely inspired, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's one of those movies that it all comes together for sure on screen, every part of it.
Yeah. And that's a testament to Jonathan. You know, I was worried about Jonathan when I first knew he was going to be the director, because I'd really wanted to do that movie for a while. I'd read the book and I tried to option the book as a producer and just, you know, I really wanted to do it. And I wasn't able to nail it down. And then it got given to Jonathan to direct. And I thought, oh, Married to the Mob.
Yeah.
My God, you know, he's going to grab onto the kitsch part he's not going to respect Clarice. And
right.
And I told him that. I mean, I told him that I was worried about it.
Wow.
And
what did he say?
Because he's kind of a silly guy, right? He wears Hawaiian shirts and he's laughing and he's joyful and happy and energetic. Yeah. And I think that what he did was he really managed the right balance, that he was able to honor the genre part of it and to not take that part too seriously, and yet to keep it as serious as a heart attack and really respect Clarice. And he got into the movie because he loved Clarice and really respected her. And if you come at the movie from that point of view, it's a very different film than it might have been had it just been like a monster movie.
When you bring up the DP on that, I'm like, I'm thinking about, because some of the most interesting parts of that movie were the kind of routines of the FBI, right? And then like all of a sudden you get into the world of the killer with the butterflies and the chaos all within that one house, sort of up against this kind of, you know, anything shot at the FBI. It's just like people doing exercises that have a regimen to them. And then you just enter this bug infested chaos pit of death. And it's like the juxtaposition is powerful. And I just talked to Scott Glenn a few weeks ago. He's fucking amazing.
I love Scott. I see him all the time because we ski together.
Oh, you do?
He lives there in Ketchum in Idaho. And I see him a lot, him and his wife.
Yeah.
Carol, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, she seems amazing too with the ceramics. And
so cool. He's such a cool guy. I mean, he's such a tough Marine. He's like a Marine feminist.
Right, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like his whole life is about feminism.
Yeah.
And about letting women take charge. And he's a super, muscle bound guy from the Marines who likes to shoot guns. And yet
he gets
it. He's just like the great liberal warrior.
So when you did Little Man Tate, was that kind of you reconciling with some of your genius kid stuff?
Yeah, I don't know that I was a genius kid. I mean, I think I was a prodigious kid and prodigious at something that was just born in me. And that was really, it wasn't math. It wasn't science. It was the ability to understand psychology,
language,
adult psychology. So I felt like in a way it was like this, it was felt like an autobiography, and yet it's not about my life at all. Mm-hmm. I really worked with Scott Frank on the screenplay a lot as a young filmmaker, and was able to really talk about things from my past and, develop the characters of the two women. The screenplay was a bit different when I got it, and we really shifted it to be about this. It's almost like two women raising this child.
Right.
And who is this herald of a new age? What does it mean to be a prodigy? A prodigy means you stand outside of this generation and you straddle into another generation, and you're going to bring everybody with you. That hope that you had for that little boy, and the fueled by the disappointment of these two women that he came from, these two opposite sides. I mean, yeah, I love that movie.
Yeah, it was a great movie. And it was like, did you like producing?
I didn't produce that one technically, even though I had to there was a lot to do because Orion went into bankruptcy right when they
were involved with the screenplay, right? And this.
Yeah. So there was a lot to do about trying to get the movie released and all that. And I had a deal with Orion, and I was had a producing deal with Orion at that time. So I was producing other movies to Orion. So yeah, I might as well have produced Little Man Tate. I like producing my own films.
Yeah.
Other than that, I don't enjoy producing. Yeah. I think it's hard. It's hard because you're always looking for things that are wrong. And there's a lot of manipulation, and there's a lot of strategizing people and
politics,
working them against each other or for each other. And that's just, it's just not my way.
Yeah. I read that. That's what's horrible about reading. When I read about how movies are made and how the actors are just played like game pieces, and because of their egos and their neediness, they're either they don't really realize it, or they're just willing to be used like that. It's very disconcerting as an actor in a way to realize that management and talent agents and producers are just going to pitch you against yourselves, against other people. They're going to use you as a bargaining chip. There's a million things that talent gets used for.
Yeah, that's true. And I mean, the whole point of having a production company was to protect people, was to protect filmmakers, and to protect the process, and to protect the product. That's why I called it Egg. That idea of sort of
your production company.
Protection.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we made some, I don't think I'm the greatest producer in the world, but we made some movies that I'm really proud of. There isn't any film that we made that I'm not proud of. And yet at the same time, it was clear when I finished the 12 years of producing that I was done. There's enough of that.
I thought Nell was a pretty gutsy movie. It's really to do that role. I mean, your ability or your willingness to explore certain types of vulnerability is pretty amazing. I mean, it's pretty terrifying for me to even think about, really, all of them, like the accused or Clarice or Nell specifically, who was basic. I mean, I know you felt a little insecure about the accused for these reasons, but did you feel uncomfortable with the vulnerability in retrospect of Nell?
I think that I was I mean, obviously I was drawn to Nell because I developed the play and, you know, got it off the ground and did all the years of work that I did to get that on screen. But I was scared of it. She is the most unlike me of anything that I've ever played. And I didn't know that I would have what it took. I think that I was scared of vulnerability and scared of being somebody like that. Like, I thought that if I was like that, I would just explode into a million pieces. Like, I just couldn't imagine what that would be. I didn't really know how to create that character. I was just so confused about how to create that character. And so it really was the greatest acting lesson of my life, where I realized, like, oh, all I have to do is drink coffee and show up and it will come because it's inside. Oh. There wasn't any books I could read particularly or research that I could do. Like, I had to just trust that when somebody said action, that I would be able to be there.
And you had to let go of a lot of who you,
a lot of who I am,
the construction of you.
Yeah. I mean, it didn't mean that I didn't like go into a trance or anything.
Right. No, but you let yourself be, you let yourself be unafraid.
I let myself be unafraid. And I really, I think that I allowed myself to believe in trolls.
Right.
And you have to believe in trolls sometimes. And it doesn't really matter whether they're real or not. It's because the belief is, you know, that's the whole point.
Right.
You know, when you're shepherding an audience through an experience like that, you have to be 100% authentic or the movie doesn't work. So there's a lot of pressure that comes with that. But there's also a lot of power to the fact that it's all riding on your performance. And if it's real, it works. And if it's not real, doesn't work.
Right. And you can see parts like I haven't done a lot of movies, but I imagine that as somebody who's done a lot of movies, when you look back at the ones where you can say, like, I don't know if I was there, or I don't love that performance, you just let it go. Right. I mean, you can't get hung up on it.
Yeah. You can get hung up on it. You can waste a lot of years getting hung up. But no, I don't. I mean, that's something I learned as a child.
Yeah.
That as an actor, I just don't have any control of it. And I have to just go. And there are rituals to do that. I feel like there's always a ritual about that, you know.
Letting go?
When I'm hanging out the window on my way to the airport after the wrap party.
Yeah.
And, you know, we wrapped at 6 a.m. and I like throw all my shit in my thing. And then there I am and I'm out the window and I undo the window. And I realize, like, half of me just finished this massive thing.
Right.
Like, I just finished climbing Mount Everest.
Yeah.
So I'm like, whew. And then the other half is like not quite back in the real life of who I am. And there's a little fear about that. That's the most delicious moment.
Yeah.
Like, and that's like, I feel like that's a ritual for me where I just go like, okay, yeah.
Yeah.
That's done. Yeah. It's over now.
That weird, the in-between. The relief of being in between worlds.
Yeah. Where you don't have the anxiety of like, do I measure up? You know, can I do it? Right. No, you just did it. It's done.
It's over. It's out of your hands.
And then 10 minutes later, or when you get off the plane on the other side in LA, suddenly you're gonna be like,
yeah,
gripped with anxiety that you don't measure up, you know?
Oh my God. I don't know how, you know, it's amazing that you still, that happens having spent your life in show business, but I guess that's the nature of this town.
I think it fuels it too, you know.
Oh, for sure.
Insecurity fuels it. You want to do the right thing. You want to go deeper. You want to be better because you keep looking for people to love you or for you to love yourself if you're better.
You want to be recognized.
Wait a minute. If I can get better, more people are going to love me. So I better get better.
And you want to be recognized for it. And you're putting your life, you're putting your creativity in the hands of, throughout your life, mostly a lot of men. That's for sure. Like directors.
Yeah.
And whatnot.
I mean, I want to be judged for the best thing that I am. I don't want to be judged for like my shoes.
Right.
You know, or some dumb thing. I want to judge, you know, so that's why it forces me to give as much as possible, to go as deep as possible, to be as authentic as possible, because I'm afraid, I don't trust anything else. Like, I'm not very good at picking shoes.
Yeah.
So if we're going to judge me on my shoes, like, I'm going to fail.
I think that's true.
And there are certain movies that are like that. I mean, Flight Plan, for example, you know, that's a super genre movie about like woman on a plane missing her child and there's a terrorist or, you know, yeah. there's, And those kind of, that movie was really hard because all the pressure was for me to, as a character, to transcend all that other stuff. Like, if you don't believe her, the whole movie's shit.
Right.
So there was a lot of, a lot of pressure to make sure that you create a character that is 100% real.
Right. Well, you brought this up twice. So that was a real lesson, that movie.
Oh yeah. Did I bring it up twice? Ooh. No. Freudian. Yes, it was. It was hard. It was a hard movie. Yeah. The challenge of doing, you know, a film that in some ways is kind of like a Hollywood construct.
Right.
And, you know, imbuing it with that heart and that realism to allow people to grab onto that so that they can believe in trolls, you know?
Right. And like, you've worked with some, like Fincher, you work with Fincher, that, and everybody says that's a, like, you want to hear a funny thing about Fincher? I did a 2.5 hour conversation with him, right? And he didn't think it was right. So
he
wouldn't let us release it. So I'm sitting on this 2.5 hour conversation with David Fincher. He's like, I don't know, let's hold off on it because I think I could do more. So like, he's,
what?
Yeah. But
yeah,
like,
he's crazy.
Right. He seems to be this, like, this perfectionist, you know, tormented guy.
He is. And he's really funny. And I love him.
Yeah.
You know, he just makes me want to put my arms around him and tell him, you know what? It is going to be okay. It's really going to be okay. You need to, like, chillax. And I love him for it. I love him that he is so committed and that he gives 100,000 times more than anybody else on that movie. I mean, and he can do any of our jobs better than we can. I mean, he's a better actor than I am. He's a better prop master. He's a better DP.
Really?
So I'm always just bow down in the presence of somebody who really is just so gifted and so committed, but it's hard to be David Fincher. I wouldn't want to be him.
But he didn't drive you crazy?
He doesn't drive me crazy. Mm-mm. I love him. He makes me laugh.
Right.
And it's true that it's annoying that you have to do as many takes as you do. And I was pregnant. So don't forget, I was pregnant on Panic Room.
Wow.
And by the end of it, I mean, you know, I was almost six months pregnant by the end of it. And by the end of it, I couldn't move. Huh. I literally could not walk down the street. I couldn't move. I had to go on bed rest after that for another 3 weeks. And despite all of that, like, I would just do anything for him.
Yeah.
I mean, I would do anything for that guy. I see, because I'm a good technician, I understand what he's looking for. Like, I understand the perfection that he's looking for, even though it might be minuscule and tiny and unattainable. And I will stand behind him and just say, like, I feel so sorry for you that you can't let that go. I just do, you know, you got to let that go, man.
Yeah. So he's never going to.
That's what makes his movies amazing.
Yeah. But I don't know how close you are with him. How does he generally feel about his movies as finished products?
He should be put in a home at the end of every movie, honestly. It's why he makes so few films. And every time that he makes one, he says, I'm never doing it again. Oh. Never. I mean, in some ways, like, I could see Fincher's whole process all over Mank.
Yeah.
I just especially love the filmmaking. I thought the filmmaking was amazing.
Yes.
And that is an incredible story. And I'm not sure that all the story was told there, right? Because the relationship between Orson Welles and Mankiewicz is so fascinating. What happened afterwards is so fascinating. And I'm not sure they touched on that.
I'm not sure he wanted to. I'm not sure what he was. I think he was trying to make it Mankiewicz's movie and not Orson Welles' movie.
Yeah.
And maybe he left some juicy shit.
Yeah, maybe that's what happened. But there's just that idea of giving everything. You know, you give everything for the opportunity to make a great work of art.
Yeah.
And
sometimes it works.
You've given blood. You've given years of your life.
Right.
Years you'll never give back. You gave up your relationships. You gave up your liver. You gave up, you know, everything. And then you hand this child over that you've protected and created. And somebody else is like, oh, let's make it a comedy.
Right,
let's put a bow on it. Yeah. Let's, you know, I mean, you can see his, like, injustice, the injustice of it all kind of on screen.
Yeah.
But at the end of a movie, every time that I see him at the end of having created a film, or even when I see him at an award show and he's created an award for it, he's traumatized by the experience of having made that movie. Always traumatized.
Well, I mean, like what you just said is so powerful, because you do what you put all that time and effort and sweat and life and love and all of that into it, and you put it out in the world, and some idiot can just go like, "Nah, it was okay." You're like, you know, without even, you know, really absorbing.
I wish I, because he is such a genius, I wish I could just like take some of my DNA out of my bloodstream and just like inject it into him, so that he's able to say to his child, like,
yeah,
you know, I wanted you to be a doctor.
Right.
But this is your life. And I did the best I could, but obviously you like music.
Right.
And you're a great musician. I can't play piano. Yeah. But, you know, you like it, and more power to you. And I hope you get that scholarship. And when you do, I'll be standing in the audience going like, whatever it is you do with your life, even if you work at Petco.
Right.
Like, that's kind of the, I wish I could take that out of my veins and put it into him, but it's not possible.
Oh, it's interesting that you have this, like, it seems that like through the course of just even this conversation, that there's definitely these guys in your life that you respect, you know, their talent, yeah, their hearts, but you feel deep connections with them. Is it because you don't have a relationship with your real dad, right?
No, I've almost never met him. I only met him a couple times in my life.
Almost never met him ever?
Well, I met him on the street a couple times.
Like, yeah, on purpose?
And I met him when he got by accident a couple times. Two, three times I met him by accident. Because I live in LA. I live like, you know, not far from him. Four times I've met him by accident, and then one time I organized it. Yeah.
When
he was like 90.
Oh, when he was 90? Now.
Yeah, because my kids wanted to meet him.
And how did that go?
It went great. He's a really entertaining, you know, old. He died recently, but he's an entertaining old dude. You know, he had his wits about him, super sharp, and he could, you know, spin a lie like nobody's business.
Oh yeah.
Super entertaining. But it's interesting that you mentioned that, like, that I have these guys that I have this fondness for. And, you know, I was raised in an industry where there are no women. It was just me. And then sometimes it was a script supervisor and occasionally a makeup artist. But other than that,
yeah,
it was just me and a guys.
Yeah.
And sometimes the lady that played my mom. But other than that, it was me and a whole bunch of guys in some small town in, like, you know, Columbia, Ohio, or wherever I am.
Yeah.
And they were my brothers, you know, and my dads, and they taught me lessons, and they taught me how to be a gentleman, and they taught me the right and wrong and how to do the right thing. And, you know, and the directors and other actors that I've worked with, you know, I really like these guys that are complicated guys that not everybody loves, and I will do anything for them. Like, I'm the sister who laughs at their jokes and just loves them. I just love them.
It seems like you keep, but it's ongoing. It seems like you add new ones every few years. Like you're still open for a few new ones to come in. Like like Mel Gibson is a problematic person to a lot of people, but you guys seem to genuinely like get each other.
Yes, and he is a problematic person, and he is warm and affectionate and loving and a really good friend and fascinating and sprightly and childlike, and, you know, he's all those things as well.
Good actor.
Great actor. A great actor and a deep, deep person. I think that's probably what has gotten him into so much trouble.
Oh yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Well, just that I think that he's a deep, deep person, and the Beaver, the character in the Beaver, you know, what he brought to that, I will always be grateful. That's a tremendous performance, and that came from his bowels. I mean, that really came from his gut.
Yeah.
And that was a lot to give. That was a real gift that he gave to me.
I think there is something to be said in terms of your appreciation of what goes into what you do and what the people in your business do. I said to my producer when I was thinking about Mel Gibson, I'm like, what, did they bury a body together? What is it? How is it? Like, what is the secret that bonds them? But I think it seems to be that your appreciation for what really goes into what we do.
He, you know, as I say to my kids, we always laugh about this. And I say to my kids, I say, look, I don't actually say this. I say something much worse, but I will say the nice version to you.
Yeah.
If you rob a 7-Eleven,
yeah,
I'm going to call the police and take you to jail, but then I'm going to visit you in jail every day. And it's not that, right. You know, yeah. I don't condone necessarily people's behaviors that are wrong, but I can't not love my children. I can't not love my family members.
Right.
And that means that you know, it's kind of Christian, you know, it's a little Catholic of me,
right.
too. Not that I was raised as a Christian, but it's, you don't abandon people in their worst moments of struggling. You extend your hand to try to teach them and to help them be a better human.
Yeah. It's a tolerance and an empathy that requires some vigilance for a lot of people. You know, too.
Yeah. And he's helped me, you know, he's helped me be a better person too.
Well, that's great. And in terms of acting, like, I mean, there seem to be points where, cause like the new movie, The Mauritanian, like there seems to be points, like I rewatched the speech at the Golden Globes where, you know, the not coming out speech, but there was also, it's so funny because that was framed by the press as a coming out speech that you couldn't win. You know,
I won.
You did.
I won because they had to quote the part where I said, even though I knew what they were going to do.
Yeah. Oh, good.
I won.
Good. But the point was made and the point still holds. And it's the same point in some ways, like a lesson that was probably part of an extension of the lesson from the events with John Hinckley, that, you know, you protect your private life and your private, you know, what at whatever cost, so you can have it.
Well, so that I can be a living, surviving person as opposed to a dead person in a hotel room with a syringe in their arm, you know, right. as awful an analogy as that is, I have survived intact. And I think as a fairly well-adjusted person, even though I'm crazy about certain things like my computer, I've survived intact by coming up with a scuba mask, you know, for lack of a better word, you know, I have a reed that allows me to breathe.
Right.
And, those survival tools are important in order for somebody to become a whole person.
Right. Yeah. And it's hard. It can take a long time to become a whole person.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not even sure I'm there yet.
Yeah. me neither. I feel that all the time. Like, you know, am I me?
Well, the worst is as you get older, I just start feeling like I start seeing other people that are blowhards or people that are like super selfish and completely self-absorbed. And, you know, and I'm just like, I was like that too. I'm still like that. That's awful. Oh no. No, you're able to really be humble and be humbled by your consciousness.
Right. Well, you know what I stopped doing? It's like, you know, I started embracing the phrase, I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, you know, like if I don't know something, I'm going to say it. You know, as opposed to pretend I know it or kind of, you know, half ask the answer. I'm just like, I don't fucking know. I, you know.
That's good. I'm going to, yes, that is.
Yeah, but you see, embrace I don't know. The humility of embracing I don't know is the best.
So, I mean, Mahamadou's story. So we, you know, for the Mauritanian.
Yeah.
Like that's another reason why I was so attracted to this is really because of who Mahamadou is. You know, Mahamadou was somebody who, and his part of 9/11 was that he was made to be fearful and was terrorized, just like, you know, we were 9/11.
Right.
And what he did with it is that through faith and through love and awareness, he was able to become a better person. And he is forgiving. He is genuinely joyful.
This is a real guy, but he paid
somebody
like,
who appreciates life and lives in the moment and is kind of childlike and curious about everyone and doesn't have a mean bone in his body. And that could have broken him. That could have turned him into a monster.
Oh my God. Are you kidding? I mean, that was crazy. I mean, I thought that the real footage of him at the end over the credits.
Yeah.
Thank God they put that in there. Because like,
and that's really who he is. Like, he is just like a goofy, just delicious, affectionate.
But he was in Gitmo for 14 years.
Yeah.
Like, but now I guess the question coming at this, guys, this is a story about him, but it's also about this lawyer, Nancy Hollander, who, like, out of nowhere, like, I grew up in Albuquerque. So when all of a sudden we're in Albuquerque, I'm like, oh my God, how did I not know this person? But but it's about her taking on the case of someone who was rounded up in post 9/11 and accused of being one of the masterminds of 9/11 because of some phone calls. And he was renditioned and then ended up in Guantanamo, and he was tortured. But what shook me up was that even after it was conclusive that he probably was not involved, you know, they kept him in there for another 7 years, 8 years.
Yeah. Well, they knew he wasn't involved. I mean, they had to have known that he wasn't involved fairly early on, because they were never able to corroborate any of the assertions, and they never charged him.
Right.
So it was really the habeas case that allowed Nancy's habeas case, when she took to the judge and said, look, you know, you can't keep people for no reason in a prison without telling them what they're there for. And the judge said, you're right. And all the evidence that they had against him had been gotten out of torture. Just, you know, really one set of confessions.
That was...
After 7 years of being tortured,
yeah.
He had one session of confessions where he admitted to everything, including being Pope. Like, basically, he was just like, whatever.
Right.
When that was thrown out and they said, you can return home, the administration kept him another 5 years just because.
And these were a Democratic administration. I mean, this was not...
Yeah,
it's not
that,
like,
was Obama.
Yeah. So... when you decide to do a movie like this, because, I mean, you sort of pick and choose fairly specifically now, you can. I mean, how do you choose a role? And outside of the story of him, was the story of Nancy compelling to you?
You know, I love the character, you know, this idea. And she's somebody that is a hero to me. You know, she believes that she has this mission, that she is there to uphold the Constitution and the rule of law, to uphold social justice and civil rights, even though a good portion, if not all of most of her clients are guilty.
Right.
And she's like, you know, I don't have a problem. I don't care what, and she'll say, I mean, I don't know, you know, it's sort of her bravado. I don't care whether they're guilty or not guilty.
Right.
If the government has a case against them, then, you know, let them
fight,
let them go to prison for the rest of their lives. I don't care.
Right.
But they deserve to be defended.
And how was Kevin McDonald to work with?
Kevin McDonald's amazing. He's so the right guy for this. You know, he has this great documentary understanding of documentary and facts, and incredibly well researched, and this sort of beautiful, even approach to being able to see all of the characters. All the characters have a point of view, but he also is just a great cinema director. You know, I think he loves being inside one character and then just looking around and saying, how does that feel? What does that look like? And that's what really makes him different than a documentarian.
Yeah, he seems like a smart director. I had one of the biggest faux pas of my life was with that guy.
Really?
Yeah, because I had him booked on this show, right, to interview him, and I thought it was Kevin McDonald from Kids in the Hall, and I was
that's hilarious.
I was expecting Kevin McDonald from Kids in the Hall, and Kevin McDonald, the film director, showed up, and I had no idea who he was, and I had to tell him to wait in my house, run out to my computer to figure out if I had seen anything he'd done, so I could not, and I didn't tell him what was happening.
That's amazing.
So I interviewed him for like a half hour, 35 minutes, which was short for me. And I couldn't put it up until I interviewed the other Kevin McDonald. And I think I believe I put them up together. And I don't think that the film directing Kevin McDonald thought it was very funny, but it was.
That's hilarious. What was it for? What movie was it for?
Which one was it? Hold on, I can tell you. Because I really thought that, like, when I talked to the publicist that showed up at my house, how do you spell him? Is it M-C-D?
M-A-C.
Oh, that was the big problem right there.
Yeah.
when the publicist showed up at my house, I was like, you know, oh, so he's directing now. That's kind of interesting. You know, like, I was literally thought that I was still talking. It was crazy, man. It was so stupid. Hold on, I'm going to tell you. It was with Saoirse Ronan.
Oh, yeah.
It was How I Live Now is what it was called. But I hadn't seen it. And it was like, I didn't think I would need to, because I'm like, Kevin McDonald will talk about Kids in the Hall. Who cares about the new movie?
Yeah.
You know, like. But I did know your work, so that was good. And I did I did watch the Mauritanian, and I was also excited to get into some of the other stuff and remember our childhood together, you on the screen, me in the movies.
Yes, that's right. And it was too bad we didn't meet.
I know. Well, I've been watching, you know, and you do seem...
I imagine you had freckles. I think you had freckles, didn't you?
I had some sunspot freckles, not real ones.
That's right, Albuquerque.
Yeah. I was on the swim team, and, you know, I had my little swim team freckles and chlorinated hair. But it was great talking to you. You are definitely you, which was exciting.
That's wonderful. Well, thank you so much. Yeah. Good meeting you. Maybe we'll do this again.
Sure. Maybe I'll see you around town once we are able to go outside.
Yeah, maybe.
All right. Take
At that
easy.
Point, you'll have one of those big, long, you know.
No, I won't do it.
Insurrectionist beards.
I've done that before. I'm not doing that. I get up. I get dressed. I shower. I act like I have a lot of things to do. I put boots on. I walk around. I have not surrendered to the isolation or the possible despair.
I just want you to know that I do have
sweatpants and slippers.
My doggy pants on.
Well, we did work today. We both did some work
That's
today.
That's true.
Take it easy, Jody.
All right. Take care.
That was an honor and a treat, people, to speak with Jodie Foster. God, she's great. The Mauritanian is in theaters now and will be available on digital platforms in the near future. Okay. Guitar time. I know. I repeat myself. I repeat myself sometimes. Boomer lives. Monkey LaFonda. Cat angels everywhere. Hey folks, this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. You know all those times you've heard guests sneeze on the show? Well, actually, you don't hear any of that because we cut the sneezes out when we're editing. But take my word for it, people definitely sneeze in here, and when they do, I've got a box of Kleenex on the table right in front of them so they can use one and get right back to business. And here's what Kleenex means to me: a tissue that will hold up. We've all used those other tissues that you blow holes right through. When I see Kleenex, I know that tissue is up for the job. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.